Welcome to the annual budget hearings for the City and County of Denver's next fiscal year. This session of the annual budget hearings begins now.
Day three of our budget hearings. This is a budget hearing for the Department of Public Health and Environment. My name is Chris Hines. I serve on City Council representing the Center City. I happen to serve as vice chair of the Safety Committee. Vice chair is very much one of those figurative things, kind of like vice president. You do very little, except in this case, Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez has given me the honor of being the chair of this committee. As we've said in every other committee, please, if the administration will make every attempt to answer every question here in this hearing, but if your question doesn't get answered, please give it to Angela Casillas by midnight tomorrow night, and she will do the things and get answers back to us by
Tuesday morning.
So, super, okay. DDPHE, please, if the mayor, actually, delay just for another 10 seconds, and give the mayor an opportunity to set up DDPHE.
Welcome, DDPHE.
All right.
Delighted to have you. I'm kidding. Thank you so much, Karen. Delighted to have you here. Excited for the conversation. Obviously, we think that DDPHE is at the intersection of so many of the crises that the city faces, and your team is out there responding and serving people in their moments of most significant need. And we're very excited about the work you're doing, not just on intervention in the moments of crisis, but on prevention upstream on so many of the issues, and we're excited to talk about the opportunities there as we look at both needs around housing, needs around mental health, needs around addiction prevention, and needs around public safety, all of which we see you as a key partner on. And so thanks so much for being here, and excited to hear from you.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to start off because I feel like if you tell everyone you're nervous, then you're less nervous, so I'm super nervous. Remember that we had to stand at a podium, I was like, what? So thanks for having me here today and wanting to learn more about our budget. The next slide has some of our top priorities for the next year. Obviously, since I've been at the department, it feels like we're spending a lot of time responding to the crises of the day. It feels very whack-a-mole-ish, and I'm wanting to make sure that we as a department are also figuring out how we still maintain and are able to support basic core public health services that we are worried about. So what are our immunization rates? What are we doing for tobacco cessation? All those, you know, important things that we're doing around equity and social determinants of health that a health department should be doing. Obviously, we're spending a lot of time and energy because it's a good way to spend our time and energy on advancing our partnerships for behavioral health issues around All in Mile High, the Roads to Recovery, and the STAR program. And then we're starting to get more involved in the safety response, and in particular to responding to gun violence and figuring out what that public health lens looks like, and we're super excited to be in that space. Next slide. I heard you all, the letter that you all sent to the mayor about the priorities that you have, and we just plugged in how we think that we're engaging with the priorities that the council has for your various, priorities. I'm not gonna read them all. If you have any questions about them, certainly happy to talk about where we feel we are in those spaces. So that's the next four slides. And then the next slide is just our organizational structure. We are in the midst of hiring a chief medical officer. Right now, many of you know that the medical examiner has been filling in for us. However, that's out of their scope of practice. So we are thinking about how we're going to fill that position. And I think it will help us from a capacity standpoint when we're talking about all this work around behavioral health and substance misuse to have a chief medical officer helping us with that strategy, so to speak. Next slide. These are our key metrics related to the Affordable Denver, Safe Denver, and Great Denver. Something that stuck out for me that I thought you might have questions about is the 6% for the All-In Mile High and providing support services in those locations. The reason that it's low right now is that we are using the wellness money to help provide those services, but their capability is limited in their ability to be in that space. And so we're working on a contract with Ascent Health that will increase our coverage by the end of the year, and we hopefully hit 100%. And then the other one that felt odd to me was the 135% that you'd see under improve city services. This is under the public health inspections. It was taking us about 2 days to respond to housing and encampment consultations, and we've got that down to either within an hour or half a day. So we're so exceeding that goal, we're at 135%. Next slide, please. Some questions about how we're addressing inequities. I'm excited to share that some of the ways we're doing this, have some new public health nurses, and they're working with Ashland Elementary, and I hope I'm saying this right, Melissa Soto Elementary, where the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination rate is about 56%. We are personally calling those families, some in Spanish, to see if we can get that rate up to 96%, so 95%. Really exciting, because that's the number you want for herd immunity, so that if someone does catch one of those diseases, the other kids and other families will not. We're also working, as you know, I always got to put a plug in for the animal shelter because it's the soft, squishy part of what we do. They're taking in more animals than ever, but we also want folks who maybe can't afford what it takes to take care of an animal to be able to have an animal. So we provide low or no cost animal services and vaccinations to those folks. And then, of course, the wellness money that's going around and providing resources and services in underserved communities. And then wanted to put a plug in for STAR, which is a new approach to how we're responding to behavioral health and substance use crises instead of just sending law enforcement. Next slide. This is just a snapshot of our budget. Slide. This is how we are using our general fund, and you can see we're mostly people. Public health is about people and providing services and creating connections. So most of our stuff is personnel related. This is a summary of our requests and changes for this next budget year. So you can see we had a $600,000 request for STAR. I'm going to highlight the ones that I think you might have questions about, and then if you have more, I'll try to answer it, or I have phone a friends. So maintaining services for STAR here is a small increase that we're requesting. This covers a change in Medicare coverage. So after COVID ended, what's covered by Medicaid has changed, and we want to make sure that we're backfilling that and making sure that we still get those services covered. There is some funding for inflationary costs for staff salaries. And then we really wanted to figure out how to better collect data around the calls and how we're able to respond or not respond for the STAR program. So as you all have probably heard, we're not able to respond to every call during the hours that we're currently supporting the program for. And a lot of you have heard we'd like to move to 24/7. I feel it's really important for us to figure out, to start off with, are there a way for us to find deficiencies in the current program? How and why we're currently able to or not able to respond to calls? And then figure out how we expand from there. So I'm hoping that this is a way to show that we support this program and we know that it's important. But I think there are some questions we need to ask and figure out how we better support this program and how efficient and effective it is. The second one is maintaining services for the Solution Center. Again, they're having an issue with some services that used to be Medicaid reimbursable. Now we're post-COVID, they are no longer, so we're backfilling that. Also some staff cost increases and supply increases for them. And then, as you know, the Roads to Recovery program, super important for us. That was grant supported and that expired. And so we're asking for general fund support to support that program. And I just want to give a huge shout out to that program. They just hit their 100th client, who said yes. They want to join Roast Recovery. They want to get support services, and we're super excited. Big shout out to staff that are working on that program. We have a lease increase for our vital records lease space. And then for the medical examiner, we're asking for another forensic assistant. These are the folks who help us pick up the decedents. We're short a person. We have a person who's actually sleeping in the office to cover the night shift. And I don't think that's acceptable from our standpoint for our employees. I think those are the big ones. If you have more questions, let me know. Next slide. These are more changes. If you have questions, let me know. Sorry. Strategies for how we are trying to meet the reduction in the sales tax revenue so that we have a balanced budget. Like many other departments you're probably hearing from, we're going to hold vacancies open. We're changing or rearranging the way we're doing inspections to try to focus more on high-risk inspections versus the lower-risk ones, reducing our service and supplies budget. And then we have some grant funds that we were able to shift some employees over to that are eligible for the work that they do. That's obviously a temporary budget reduction strategy because grants are not a permanent funding source. Okay, so I understand that we were asked last year to reduce services and supplies to support some other activities, and this is how much we reduced and the impact to our department. Sorry, I talk really fast. These are some of the ARPA contracts that we still have outstanding. And you can see that we're trying to get two outstanding ones executed by the end of this month. Next slide. And then back to our soft squishy part. You all have in the hopper an expansion of the Denver Animal Shelter. And we're hoping that this year actually is going to be where we start designing what that expansion will look like as part of that $10 million appropriation. This is what our general fund expenditures and revenues and FTEs have looked like over the past several years. Hopefully nothing shocking there. This is the Environmental Quality Enterprise Fund revenue and expenditures. Hopefully, I don't know, if there's anything shocking, just let me know. Okay. The next slide, the one thing that I thought you all might be curious to know is that $48.2 million bar. It seems odd. It's not because we're going to spend way more than we have. And I think two council members who sit on this committee are with us today. They can talk to this a little bit more. This is because we're giving out multi-year grants. And so you're going to see that they're not expending it all in the same year. Some of it in 1 year, some of it in year two, some of it in year three. And so there's that weird bump. It looks like we're spending more than we have. It's actually, it's been appropriated, not all spent. And so it will all even out. Next slide, please. Caring for Denver, which is the contract that we oversee, but obviously there's a board that oversees those expenditures and its priorities. Next slide. The nicotine, obviously there's kind of a weird little bar there as well. You may all be familiar with the fact that the folks who create the vaping products settled nationwide, and that was our piece of the settlement. You see that bump in 2024. Next slide. This is the opioid settlement fund expenditures, and Councilman Parody is on that. Council, commission, what do we call it, sorry. But they're pretty good at spending what they bring in as well. Oh my gosh, that's my last slide. Hashtag winning.
Did you see that with your last slide?
Yeah, I think it is. Stephanie's not keeping up.
I like the messaging. Here's some numbers if you have questions. Fortunately, we do have questions.
It feels painful to go through line by line, so I figure it's just easier to answer questions if you have.
I think we've tried to target about half of the presentation, or half the hearing for the presentation and half for questions. We've got a quarter for the presentation and three quarters for questions. So thank you so much. Let's start with Councilmember Parody, Councilmember Cashman on deck.
Yes, thank you so much. And Karen, it's so nice to finally have someone in your role and to be hearing from you. Welcome, hello. So first question is about STAR. Unsurprisingly, I'm sure other members will learn more about that program as well, because it's something that everyone here has, you know, participated in and watched closely for as it's grown over the years, and that we're proud of. I was looking at the $600,000 that's showing up as an increase, but also I think I heard you just say that that's covering for Medicaid reimbursement that won't be coming into the providers. Is that right? Okay.
And staff salary, some staff salary increases.
Great. Good. Glad they're getting those. So the service level of STAR will be flat with that investment. Is that right?
My understanding is there's still a little bit extra in there to see if we can expand services. So there's an additional supervisor in there. One of the limitations of the STAR program is you have to have a ratio of supervisors to those who are going out and responding to the calls. And so by adding another supervisor, we should be able to ensure that we're utilizing the vans more efficiently and having those staffed. And we've been in some cases where there's only been one supervisor, so we're limited to how many people can go out and respond. And so by hiring that second supervisor, we should be able to, I hope, respond to more calls during those core hours.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful to know. Well, in that supervisor, where will that person, which contract will that person be under?
I'm sorry.
Will that person be hired at one of the STAR contractors or at DEPHE?
That's
okay.
Tristan. Hi, Tristan Sanders, Director for Community Behavioral Health. That supervisor position is at Wellpower, which is the mental health clinician arm of STAR.
Okay, great. And so if they hire one additional supervisor in 2025, though, there's not a thought that they would be able to add more staff under that person in this year's budget?
Not in the current budget, but Karen's trying to explain if we can have additional supervisory capacity, then all the clinicians that are actually already hired can work at a time because they work under the supervisor. And so we can be more efficient with the resources we have.
Could you translate that, not necessarily in person this hearing, but in follow-up, could you translate that into how much capacity that will mean, like being able to utilize those people more effectively because there's more supervision present, which I get is a requirement for medical folks a lot of the time?
Yeah, we can follow.
Okay, cool. So I also have questions about roads to recovery, and I'm sorry because I'm actually very surprised that I managed to get in the queue first. Is there a slide on roads that we can go back to, or is that not in here?
There was something.
Yeah, I'm finding it. Sorry, guys. You know what, Mr. Chair, do you want to put me out of the queue? I'll come back and ask about roads in an organized fashion and not waste everybody's time.
Great. Thank you. Councilmember Cashman, Councilmember Elvitris on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, thank you for the presentation. I'm wondering about your department's intersection with youth. Is there a specific section of your agency that deals with youth, or how? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So I'm still learning about our department. I feel like we do have youth work. It is not centralized per se, and so we have someone who works on suicide prevention, and got this is like their big campaign working with school kids around suicide prevention and providing wraparound services. Nakshan is working on a grant to work with DPS schools around high-risk kids and sending culturally and linguistically appropriate folks into those spaces to ask about high-risk kids and to do what I call the aggressive hugging. How you doing today? What do you need today? Did you follow up? I can follow up for you. I will get that service for you. There's a really lovely expose, is not the right word, coverage of that program on our Channel 8 that they just posted recently. If you want to learn more about that program, they're doing really good work. We have maternal child health section working on very young youth, working mostly in that child care realm. We are starting to talk with the Office of Children's Affairs about how we can support their youth plan, and really concentrating on accessible, affordable childcare, and then youth growth and development, and what we're doing for workforce development, and then after school activities and things that we do to support youth around social determinants of health, because we know that if we support them at this point in stage in their life, we're gonna have better outcomes on the other side. We're also talking to the Office of Children's Affairs about sharing their Youth Advisory Council. We have a lot of thoughts about how we could really utilize them in informing how we prioritize things in our decision making, so we're super excited about that aspect as well.
It sounds like great work that you're doing. I'd love to see a Youth and Family Services division of DDPHE just to focus all that. My other question is, you made a statement, you said you oversee Caring for Denver, but their board oversees the expenditures. What is your oversight amount to?
Thank you. So we oversee the contract, so money in, money out for Caring for Denver, the contract, but the decisions about how funding is prioritized, who gets the funding, is done by the Caring for Denver. I think they're called a board. Commission? Whatever they're called. they're so...
Crowd.
Crowd, the crowd. So we sit on it. I think there might be council members who sit on it as well, or no? So city, so us, the attorney's office, human services, Denver Health, Kristen can probably name the others, who sit on that commission.
That's fine, thank you. That's all for now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Cashman, Councilmember Alvarez, with Councilmember Sawyer.
Thank you. Thank you for the information and your brief overview. I would say something that I have heard about and would like to know more about is your immunization program. I know with the migrant newcomer population, that's been an issue that they may not have the immunizations they want. So is that fully funded? What does the funding for that look like this year compared to last year?
Thank you. So I'm not sure I know the detail about the funding amount. I know that we have a new program with health nurses, which we're super excited about. We've been working with Denver Health to figure out, make sure that we're not overlapping services and we're not in the same spaces. But they've been very helpful because they've been stationed at the newcomer center and doing intakes and asking about their health history and providing vaccinations if we think they need them or if they request them. And then more recently, my example of some of the newcomer kids are going to some very specific schools and really trying to get out to those schools and making sure that the kids are immunized with those important, particularly spreadable viruses or diseases they could get if they're not vaccinated. So we're kind of in the beginning stages because, as you know, a lot of those services were just Denver Health, and we're growing up as a public health agency, and we should be in that space, and in particular in spaces where other folks can't be. But then I think it's also important for us to work with our other community health providers. As you know, Tepeyac does really great work in their community, and we don't need to be in that space because they're in that space. And so trying to figure out how we leverage what other people are doing and where there are gaps, I think, is a really important or good opportunity for us.
I would agree. I think overall it is a little confusing when we're trying to get people to resources, like which way do we go and what's best. And piggybacking off of that, I see an increase in personnel for the environmental public health program supervisor, some 2.5 FTE, along with an increase in services of supplies to the Roads to Recovery program creation, which I'm very excited about. I'm curious, how is the agency coordination between DDPHE, host, and safety at the moment for these programs?
That's a really good question. And so I think we're all growing and learning. We are definitely sharing other our work and how we can support each other. So with host, there's obviously, if you look at the Venn diagram and the overlap with Roads to Recovery, All in Mile High, Solution Center, STAR, a lot of these are the same folks that we're trying to serve, provide wraparound services and get them on the road to recovery, right? So lots of conversations with host about where folks are getting housed and how we provide the correct wraparound services when they're in that space. And that's going to be a huge focus for us, I think, this next year. And ramping up Roads to Recovery and figuring, and the Ascent care managers, wraparound services. I think we have a huge opportunity for peer supporters, which are people with lived experience who can help you and say, I've been there, and I know this is really hard, or you know, that didn't feel right. How do I find you a different provider? How do I find you a different source of support? So we're also on the fire team for the PNI and the gun violence space, and trying to, I call it infiltrate our public health lens and help people think differently about what's happening in that space and how we do it.
Awesome. And then I'll wrap up and get back in the queue. I would like to know a little bit more about, it seems like there's a almost 10% increase in the clean air and water quality activities along with FTE. What exactly is the impetus for this increase? It's something that I care deeply about and that I think we have a lot of work to do in, so I'm excited to learn what those new positions will be addressing.
I will take a high-level stab, and if that's not sufficient, I have a phone effect.
Okay, great.
So one increase is in the Love My Air program. So one of those FTEs is to work in DPS schools, and the other part of that work is we've expanded where we have air quality collection monitors, and we're specifically placing them at clinics. In addition to, we have some at schools. So the hope is, looking in the future, if we have like a bad ozone day, or we think we're seeing something from Suncor, for example, that air quality monitor, it will be in the clinic. They'll be able to see the data, and they'll be able to compare it with if we see an increase or change in who's coming to the clinic and for what reason, if there's a correlation or causation. I'm hoping that's going to help inform that decision making. I think there was an indirect increase in indirect for providing services. So as you know, that fund supports a lot of our other departments. So for example, real estate wants to buy a piece of property. The air quality program goes in and does an assessment on that property to let you know if there's any kind of warning bells, what's in the soil or what's underneath the soil. I'm going to stop there because those are the ones that stick out to me. If there's something specific, let me know.
Yeah, I think just piggybacking on that, the second part is when we purchase real estate, we usually do an environmental assessment by a third party, so that seems kind of redundant for us to do our own. So
we'll see the contract for that.
Okay, that makes more sense. And then the air quality monitoring, I love that. However, a lot of underserved neighborhoods don't have a clinic or they don't have a school. And so I want to flag that for you. That's something that's really important to me, as I feel like I have some of the most polluted neighborhoods in the city, and they don't have necessarily schools in those really high pollution areas or clinics. So just want to highlight that. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Sawyer with Councilmember Romero Campbell on deck.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, you guys. This is very interesting, I think, and helpful information. I'm asking the same question of all of the different city agencies that have front-facing staff members. So to help make up the $40 million shortfall for this year, we are looking at holding positions. A lot of those positions are revenue-generating, and a lot of those positions are direct community engagement facing quality of life type things, right? We're talking food inspectors, we're talking about our animal control inspectors, we're talking about all of those different kinds of things. How is DDPHE going to be affected by this hiring hold? Are you gonna have the front-facing staff you need in order to be able to do those public health jobs for 2025?
I mean, I think it would be disingenuous to say there was no impact, but I think that what we're trying to do is figure out how we don't impact critical services while we know we're having to leave some of these vacancies open. So I'll use the two examples that you gave. So one is PHI folks, who are doing inspections. So we already do a risk-based assessment, right? So if someone's a frequent offender, we go back and visit and try to get better behaviors or change outcomes, right? That will continue, but I think you will see us less in the even more low-risk areas. So we've been inspecting schools. That's been a part of our regular flyby. That we're going to have to move to complaint-based. The state also has a school inspection program, so we might have to call on the state to back us up if we can't make it. We might be inspecting places that are considered lower risk, for example, don't have as much perishable food. So if you don't have like meats or dairy products, you might not see us as often or at all, except if there's a complaint based. But places where we know our pinch points and our frequent issues, we will continue to be in those spaces because we know it's important from a customer service perspective and from the perspective of our residents who might say notice that this is a continual pinch point or in their community. We want to still be in that space and help be resolution focused. Animal shelter is going to be kind of in the same situation. We might be more complaint-based than some other things that we might be doing that's more upstream and proactive.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Second question, I don't really understand the interplay between DDPHG and the Office of Social Equity and Innovation. This might be a question for you when it comes to the STAR program, right? STAR was moved into DDPHG at the request of council because it is a public health issue. There is, I think, a 911 operator that is in OSEI. How does that work, or does it work? And is STAR moving into OSEI?
Karen, can you give an update on sort of the current division of operations in terms of what, and it's really the Office of Neighborhood Safety component that lives within OSEI, you're exactly right, that brought the safety team over that manages part of that. So you can give the current allocation on who owns which part of the operations presently, and then I would just say we're in ongoing conversations with both teams about what's working here, what's the best for the teams, what's the best for providers, what makes it the smoothest. There were parts that were previously still separated between safety and DDPHE. The parts that were in safety are now in OSEI, so it's just a move of that function. But we're looking at still whether there are ways to streamline that. But you, you want to give Karen or Tristan or someone an overview of which current operations live under OSEI and which live under DDPHE?
I think you both explained it really well, right? So the 911 component is now under the Office of Neighborhood Safety so that we can put that public health lens layer the public health lens with it. We don't necessarily just need law enforcement to respond to all of our calls. As you know, like, this is the brilliance of STAR and the work that it does. Right now, the contracts and the informal committee that exists is staffed by us and managed by DDPHE. I think we all have to acknowledge that right now it feels squidgy and kind of awkward, and everyone's like, so who does what and why? And I think we need to figure out what that looks like and have some more conversations, but in the way that is most supportive of that program and helping it be successful and effective.
Okay. That really concerns me because the purpose of STAR being in DDPHE is because it is a public health program. To move it out of a public health program and into a program that is safety adjacent is literally taking us back to where we were when STAR first was a pilot program and lived in safety, and that is very concerning to me. So thank you for that information. I will just flag that for you guys. I think that's very concerning.
Yeah, just to be clear, all the items that are under Office of Social Economic Innovation were moved there to no longer be under safety. That's the reason why they exist, is not to have safety adjacency, is to be community facing in their design. And so not that that means that these services need to move there, but that is the reason why all the program that's in Office of Neighborhood Safety, the reason why advocates pushed for them to go there was STAR was the first version of saying there are some services that should not be safety adjacent. Then there were a whole bunch of other ones people said also should not be safety adjacent, and so that was what moved the Office of Neighborhood Safety. So I would say these are much more alike products that are non-safety than them being safety. Doesn't mean it's the right spot, but just to be clear, that is the design of what.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you and agree with you 100%, and I'm so excited that we have an Office of Neighborhood Safety. So certainly not to judge that, but it really concerns me that there is one move to a 911 operator, I get it. STAR is a public health issue and should be in public health, and so I don't really understand. I don't think we've been briefed on like what might be coming on that. But if it is coming that STAR is moving to OSEI, I have a lot of concerns about that. So
there's no plan in place for that to happen right
okay.
now.
Awesome. Really appreciate that. Thank you. And then I noticed that our tobacco sting health SRF is up like 965%. And as much as I fully support that, I'm excited about it. I have three teenagers. Like half their friends vape, maybe more, and it's really concerning. I'm curious, is that because we got a grant? Is that, like, why so much this year, and what does that look like?
Yeah, so that's because of the national vaping settlement.
Okay.
And so you see that injection of funds, and I agree with you, vaping is a big concern. However, it is going down in Colorado. We were, like, number two, which is bad to be number two in that place. I think the work in this space that we've been doing as local public health agencies and from the state's perspective, we've really been working on figuring out how to reduce the vaping prevalence in underage.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, I ran the first round of tobacco flavor ban legislation that was vetoed by the former administration. And one of the compromises that we came to after that veto was additional inspections by DDPHE into the tobacco space, which Tristan and his team have been doing an amazing job of. But what we're seeing is, my concern is if we've got less inspectors because we're holding these positions open because they are, you know, because we have a staffing freeze based on our budget overage, that we're not going to be able to do those inspections and continue that level of enforcement that we need in order to not be second anymore.
Thank you for that comment. I hope I have this right. They're going to kick me if I do not. The tobacco inspection program is actually in behavioral health, not under Danica, right. Because we have this grant and we've moved and shifted folks to the grant. We're going to do full inspections. I had to look at a person to make sure I could say that.
I appreciate it. That's all I wanted to know. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Council Member Romero Campbell and Council Torres. Monday.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Committee Chair, I have a question, and this is really around a lot of the residential, or what would it be called, the rental licensing program and inspections. And I know that you do a lot of collaboration with excise and licensing. I was looking in the budget where that line item is, and knowing that there has been an increase in landlords getting their license, there's an inspection process, and there are also a number of inspectors that go out and look and respond to rental violations, right? Or rental issues that might be there. Hot water, trash, rodents, is it livable, asbestos, etc. With that increasing, where is it in the budget? And it seems as though people are stretched really thin throughout the city. Is there a plan for an increase in staffing for that program?
I have to phone a friend about the budget and the licensure and the revenue.
Sure.
And then I have to phone a friend about how we're currently inspecting and what that looks like.
Councilman, we are not expanding that particular component. It is within the public health investigations, and Danica can talk a little bit about the experience in terms of supporting that program. I will say when we work with excise and license, they were not anticipating a significant number of landlords coming online in 2025. That 2023 and 2024 had been years of a lot of folks coming on board, so we believe it's going to level off in 2025, but I will let Danica talk a little bit about her experience and her team's experience in terms of the actual inspections themselves.
Good morning, Danica Lee. I'm the Director of the Public Health Investigations Division, within which the Residential Health Program resides. So our staffing levels are not changing here. We work closely with licensing. I will say our approach over the last 5 years in terms of how we conduct inspections and how we conduct enforcement has changed to become more efficient. So going back a couple years, you would find numerous visits and citations of a violation. Now we move much more quickly to issuing fines, and you can see that reflected in like what our fine amounts look like. But not going to lie, it is a tremendously exciting but also challenging program, especially with all of the interplay of tenants' unions and the licensing components. So it's very dynamic and changing year to year, and I think as we're looking ahead to 26, we need to evaluate, do we need to request additional resources for that program?
Thank you. I think that at the current capacity, it seems as though things are just really stretched. Thin, and the amount of times that I know inspectors have had to come out in my district, we have some areas that have just been, you know, large number of units, 400 plus units that are really struggling, and they just want hot water, and they just want to have some opportunity for the for there to be enforcement of those landlords to be able to provide hot water and livable conditions. And so I'm just really concerned that as we're talking about affordable housing, as we're talking about expanding our outreach to additional landlords, that actually the need will increase
that we will need additional inspections, that we will need additional licensing inspectors there. That's one thing. And then the second is, are there any plans from DDPHE to kind of change what that system currently is? I think that there are some challenges in the process to have a third party do the inspection for those landlords. Is there any talk about bringing that in-house and having that be covered by the city as opposed to outsourcing with third parties?
So in terms of the third party inspectors, in order to secure that license, this 30 party inspection entity comes in. When you look at the number of units in Denver, when we're talking about housing stock, estimates are around like 55,000 plus. We do not have the capacity to handle that internally while still sustaining a robust response to complaints that we might receive. We are working with licensing to investigate any concerns that might come up with the third party inspectors, also talking to tenants, advocates, and whatnot. So there is some active work going on in that area.
Just one last comment to that. Is there any consideration for the enforcement or violation or fines for those inspectors that are clearly violating and passing through landlords or passing through inspections that shouldn't be passed?
So excise and license is kind of where that program resides. So that's probably, I don't want to speak out of turn, it's probably a good question for them, but there have been some concerns that have come up about a few particular situations that we've worked with them on to investigate. Those have just come up kind of in the last few months. So I think that is a dynamic issue that we'll be hearing more about.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's something that I would love to be able to continue the conversation. I know myself and others are interested in this topic. And I appreciate the work and the attention that your office, that DDPHE has had, and working with excise and licensing for a specific property owner, a landlord, apartment building in District 4. And I don't think we've come to resolution as to what that looks like for over 400 units. But I do appreciate that it's working and moving forward. So just wanted to say that. Thank you. Thank you, Committee Chair.
Thank you. Councilmember Romero-Campbell, we have 18 minutes left, 5 people in the queue for round 1, a few already ready for round 2. Council Torres next, Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, and it was good to talk to you as you came on board. The first question that I have, Council requested the development of a food justice fund. And so I want to talk about food just a little bit and the bank of that work that lives largely in DDPHE for the city. I think predominantly in DDPHE for the city. And that's everything from licensing and inspecting food establishments to supporting the food networks and community. Our food pantries have been overwhelmed. I pushed to the max. I don't know that we've done or if we should do an assessment of the stability of our food pantry system in the city, because ours are increasing. Revision, for example, had about 750 families that came early July. That's increased to over 850 families just last week. And that's weekly for families that are coming for food assistance. Denver Inner City Parish, Bienvenidos. Like, I'd really love to understand where they're at. And that was one of the reasons we requested a food justice fund, was because a lot of those organizations probably have already kind of reached where they can reach with existing food systems and SNAP benefits kind of recipients and things like that, and really need other financial support to build up a refrigeration system, a pantry system, its network to provide fresh food. So just want to ask if that was a conversation that was raised about a food justice fund. If not, can we still consider that this year, next year, in trying to figure out what does that mean? What does it look like? What does it fund? I would really love to be able to think about what this looks like. You've got two plans in DDPHE to deliver, and I think this fits well within the goals of those plans.
Phone a friend.
Okay.
I feel like your question is super timely because since I've been here, I've been thinking about where all the different pieces of food security exist, and the work being done in various spaces. And I will say that we have a staff that is super passionate about food security, food justice, and trying to figure out how we better align all of that work with sister agencies and with our community-based organizations. So when we've met with DHS, because as you know, they provide a different kind of access and support than we might do through Healthy Foods and Healthy Kids.
Healthy Food for Denver.
Thank you. Which is separate from the big umbrella Food Council, which is different from what are our policies around food and what do we support. I feel like we're missing components around seniors who want to age in place and in their homes and how we provide food security in that space. If kids are feeling food insecurity, I'm pretty sure their parents and families are. How do we think about this from a bigger perspective and the funding sources and creating alignment and figuring out what that looks like long term? I'm really excited to have this conversation.
The funding source expires in 4 years.
And then specifically, Susan wants to add anything about food.
So we do have the food systems team and community behavioral health. They work very closely with the interagency group across the city. A couple of things that may speak to what you're asking. So first of all, the Southwest Food Coalition is trying to start a food justice fund. We provided a letter of support, and we continue to provide ongoing access and technical assistance to other funding sources that might be able to start that. A lot of the work that we're doing currently in DDPHE is very neighborhood focused. We don't have the best, like, citywide food system, so we're working at a neighborhood level through some grant funding we have through the state to work with a variety of neighborhoods across Denver to look at their own sort of micro food systems and what can be done. That, along with the Healthy Food for Denver Kids initiative, which is really nutrition and food purchasing, as you just so well noted, it expires in 4 years. I think there's an opportunity to look at what that initiative is, how it may or may not exist into the future, and what it can actually fund. Because right now it can literally purchase food and provide food education. Maybe that needs to expand, we don't know.
So can I ask for that planning and strategic conversation to include members of council in the next couple of years? I get if we can't seed it in 2025, but we've got to start talking about how do we start planning more strategically for it. So I would just make that ask.
So there's two members of council that sit on the Healthy Food for Denver Kids Commission.
I'm aware, yeah. That's very specific and probably part of this bigger, yeah.
I'd be super excited to work with you on that.
Okay. My second question is about the Solutions Center. They are only taking mental health need clients, not substance abuse clients. What is that looking like in the future, and when does their contract expire?
That contract is up at the end of the year. We are in active discussions with Wellpower, the contractor that runs that facility, about how they might be able to expand into substance use treatment. It's a big undertaking on the infrastructure side, but also on the licensure side. So there's a lot that Wellpower would have to do in the form of getting the proper clinicians, the proper folks with the proper licensure to be able to provide substance use treatment and withdrawal management, et cetera. I don't think we can commit to anything here today, but I hope that in 2025 we can be talking very seriously about how the Solution Center provides substance use treatment services.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Council Torres. Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez with Councilmember Watson on deck.
Great, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So I want to go off of what Council President, around the Behavioral Health Solution Center. So there is an increase, it looks like, for that on that budget for $1 million. And I'm curious of how much has been spent over the last 2 years. And I ask this because, and I see, like, in the budget book, I see the last 2 years that the amount allocated. I want to know how much has actually been spent of that amount. If that's the actual spend amount, okay, great. But my concern is that my understanding is that it has been very highly underutilized, that there's not a lot of people going through there. So then my question is, what are we doing with the unspent funds? And so for 2024, since that's where we're at now, and we're almost halfway, more than halfway through the year. Just kind of curious what that, what we predict that will be underspent for that. And I also know there's some nexus around programming going forward, and I get why the $1 million for the most part, if we're talking about things like roads to recovery, but I'm asking for the current year and knowing that historically it has been very underutilized.
Yeah, so sort of two questions there. How many people are they serving? What does the funding look like? Let's deal with the funding first. So peek under the hood, the way the Solution Center works is there's a main floor, which is the crisis stabilization unit, shelter floor. Wellpower is the contractor, they operate both. There are no billable services provided on the shelter floor. There are lots of billable services provided on the crisis stabilization unit. So the funding mix looks like about a third, a third, a third. So it's a third that covers the shelter, a third city funding that covers the crisis stabilization unit, and a third that's billed to Medicaid. Historically, they've actually been under budget in the sense that they've not even covered the expenses that they've incurred. So Wellpower has actually eaten a lot of the cost on the Solution Center because they're providing more services than they get reimbursed for and more services than we even provide funding for. And so what you see in the budget book for the general fund expenditures for the Solution Center is what they spend every single year. It's that, and then they're even taking a loss. And so part of what the $1 million is going to do is actually support it, filling a little more of that gap so that they don't have to take quite as big of a loss. That loss just got bigger because of the Medicaid issues, and making sure that we have the right staffing structure and licensure so it's running properly. On the people served side, on average, they were serving about 1,200 to 1,400 people a year. In 2024, that's up to about 1,600 people. I think we've gotten better at the referral sources. I would say that a lot of the people served is up to us. It's a referral-only facility, and so the more teams that we want to open that up to be able to directly refer people to the Solution Center, the more people are going to be able to serve. We have to balance that with the staffing, so we have to make sure that they have the right staffing levels at the right time so that they can serve the number of people we're sending to them, and I think we've gotten a lot better at that. That should be reflected in 2024 numbers of that increase in people. But at full capacity currently, we think 1,600 to about 1,800 people is about what they can serve at full capacity in a year. So we're getting close to that.
Thank you for that. And then the second question I have is around the overdose deaths. So we see that continue to increase, and stated in the budget book on page 418, I'll just read, the Denver Office of Medical Examiner saw a historic increase in caseload starting in 2020, which has been driven by several factors, but more than the increase in overdose deaths. Preliminary 2024 data show a 118% increase in overdose deaths with the same months in 2019. I just want to point to that and want to know where I can be pointed to in the budget book where we are meeting these needs with this issue and that is causing so much harm in our communities, right? And so I was trying to look for where's the, you know, I found the harm reduction line item. There wasn't anything allocated. I saw that was a grant. And so I'm just curious is where can I find what we're allocating towards these efforts? What does that look like?
I think there's a number of places you could look. I mean, first, in community behavioral health, we have behavioral health lines that do, we have two sections of behavioral health. We have access to care and substance misuse. Most of that substance misuse section is actually funded by grants and some general fund. So you could look in the grant line, you'll see an overdose data to action grant. We did a press release about it, $9 million over the next 5 years. That's where a lot of the harm reduction funding and a lot of the data around overdose deaths will be contained. And then the other place is the opioid settlement funds. I mean, this is a huge settlement fund that's coming to the city. We've got the state commission that's guiding a lot of those resources. That will be the primary support for how to address those deaths in the city going forward. And that lives in EOF, not in our section of the budget.
Thank you. We'll send you the page number.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Councilmember Watson, Councilmember Lewis on deck. We've got about 7 minutes.
Thank you, Committee Chair. A quick question. I know Council President Pro Tem Romero Campbell asked about investigators. I want to be a little more specific when it comes to the investigators, specific for housing compatibility. I did my best to try to track down the listing and the funding. I was able to find on page 424 a listing of FTEs. Can someone describe to me kind of the breakout of your investigators? Specific to housing habitability, how many investigators do we have? within the city, and where is that funding going for this year?
I have to phone a friend.
No problem. I thought Danica was coming on.
Thank you for that question, Councilman Watson. We have 9 investigators who are largely dedicated to the residential health program. A few of them are cross-trained in other programs, so not quite 9 FTEs, and then we have 2 supervisors as well. And then the second question was, what about the funding?
Just simply looking at the funding stream, it wasn't clear to me if funding for investigators was going down, was staying stable. I couldn't find the 9 that you just described either as far as how they're funded. So talk me through a little bit of that.
Yeah, sure thing. So they're general funded positions, permanent positions, and the section of our work org that the residential health program is in includes a number of other programs too.
Okay.
For 25, we're holding 1 position open. So there will be some very small impacts to the residential health program, but the work that we're doing in that program continues to be one of our high priorities.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I'll send some additional questions.
Councilmember Lewis, you're good? Okay. I have one question about STAR and hiring and procurement. I know that in previous years we've had supply chain issues getting the STAR vans, and also challenges getting social workers and paramedics. How are we with that? Have we caught up?
Pretty good. No, I think the issues that we saw during the pandemic are not really existent now. I think the largest part of the underspend in a lot of the contractor budgets resides at Denver Health, and that's mainly around the difference between paramedic and EMT. Either is acceptable under our contract. We budget for paramedics, we often get EMTs, and so there's a big difference in that salary, and that's what leads to some of the underspend in that contract.
Great.
The issues that we had before are not as acute as they were during COVID.
Yeah, I see that we actually even have the STAR vans labeled in now, so that's awesome. Councilmember Parity, round 2.
Thank you so much. This is sort of a new topic, and I'm just curious about your thinking around it. So being on the Opioid Commission, very, very concerned about xylazine coming here, and have been reading and learning a lot about that. My understanding is that it comes with a lot more wound issues and amputations. So just, another dimension to the public health opioid crisis. I'm curious whether there's like a DDPHE and host conversation happening about the needs of people who have experienced that kind of amputation or have like serious wound care, getting their needs met in shelter, right? Because that's like a lot of medical care to be providing to someone who may be experiencing unsheltered homelessness simultaneously. Sorry, big question. I can ask that via email if it's not on the top of your heads today.
So we actually just met with the Denver Rescue Mission, who's experiencing some similar issues, how to provide support and care for folks from a licensure perspective and a risk perspective. And I think that we're dealing with similar things, so it's definitely a topic of conversation. And then Tristan might have some more thoughts about like how we're gonna try to actually tackle it, provide services.
Yeah, so in shelter, I mean, I think specifically is in the All in Mile High shelters, we are stepping into it in a big way with host what those services look like to include behavioral health services, but also we had a great conversation with Coalition for the Homeless last week about what physical health, mental health, oral health, et cetera, services could be provided in those spaces. So we're moving in that direction. We've got some funding to support that, and we'll be looking at how we can provide a lot of those health services, but also getting people to those health services. So it's not just that you bring them and people will come, but of putting some case management support on the ground to be able to get people directly to those health services, we think will be really helpful.
Okay, yeah, thank you. And just to be clear, that's why I'm thinking of it as a budget question, right? Is because it's like a new dimension of healthcare needs and services that we're already trying to meet so much need. I also wanted to say that my understanding is from meetings that were happening last week with ONS that the aid center is going to continue, or is going to move from safety and live within ONS. And I am a little disappointed to see that, because I think that the Roads to Recovery program that DDPHE has been very thoughtfully developing is really where that facility should live. having had a lot of sort of extra briefings on Roads to Recovery that the full council hasn't necessarily gotten. I just want to, I've seen the results already among the Roads to Recovery team just doing outreach and getting people this really specialized case management, the people that are, you know, the really frequent jail users, kind of this super small list of folks that we just need to focus on. That's already been really impressive and really successful. And I think the need for a diversion touch point and a drop-off point then for, you know, police and other first responders who are encountering folks on that list or similar folks as we expand, you know, the scope, is just so clear. So it's not that ONS, I don't think, should have a role there, but it feels to me like in order for that kind of diversion to work within Rhodes, like DDPHG and Rhodes need to have ownership of that facility and operational control and then work with, you know, all the other uses that we see for that space. So that's a comment, unless there's something you guys want to say about that. And I will also say that understanding the funding that Rhodes has, the Opioid Commission funding, the clinicians, and all of that, I think is, I would love for all of council to have a better understanding of that before we all vote on a final budget, since you guys had so much to go over today, but that's been such a key focal point and initiative for all of us, so.
Yeah, thank you. We're at time, so I have Councilmembers Cashman and Almendrez in the queue. If you will get your questions to Angela Casillas by midnight tomorrow night, she will collect them, and anyone else who has questions that didn't get answered, she'll collect them and get them back to us by Tuesday mid-morning. Great, thank you so much. Thank you, DDP. Thank you, Mayor. Do you have any final comments?
No, thank you so much, team, for your work, and thanks for the presentation, really helpful.
Great, we're adjourned.